Joel Looney, for those of you that don't know, I'm one of the teaching pastors here. This is our fourth week in a series called What's Going On. We've used Marvin Gaye's song of the same name as our inspiration for the series. A song that came out in 1971. I thought after 4 weeks you guys might have, or, you know, 3 weeks. So the 60s and 70s were a very loud time. Certainly loud in terms of sheer volume, as music reached unprecedented decibel ranges. In 1972, the year following, Deep Purple held the record from the Guinness Book of World Records for the world's loudest band, because in a concert in the London Rainbow Theater, their sound reached 117 decibels. Three of their audience members were rendered unconscious. So certainly loud from the music that was blaring on the radio, but probably also loud because of what was beneath the music, right? All the discontent of the previous decades collected, culminated, coalesced, and found thunderous voice during that chaotic era. We Americans were mired in an unwinnable war in Vietnam, one in which seemed to lack the moral imperative of World War II, but which required the same cost of life and sanity for our sons and our brothers and our fathers, as well as the families they left behind, those they were presumably fighting for. And that vision of the tormented Vietnam veteran coming home to his community with the baggage of the atrocities he witnessed haunting his dreams has been revisited in recent years, as we've welcomed home yet another wave of tortured troops. To see a young man or young woman who left whole, to see the best we had to offer go with courage and return with fear, to see someone who gave their very soul to fight for freedom return a slave to anxiety and paranoia. It's the vision of a fierce warrior ducking for cover on the 4th of July, not at the sound of bombs, but the muted popping of firecrackers lit by a son or daughter, niece or nephew. The memory of what was makes a mockery of what now is, that fractured reality we see before us. And we see this with people, and we see it in our communities as well. And the troubles in our world reflect the troubles in our lives. And the trouble in our lives manifests in trouble in our communities, in this community. When we look around at our neighborhoods, we often cry out, "What's going on?" And when we ask what's going on, as we've said before, we're expressing our need for peace. And we ask this question not as a friendly greeting, but as that desperate cry of a community in anguish and uncertainty. How many of you hear gunshots in your neighborhood? Yeah. How many people see folks dealing drugs on the corners? Right there next to you. How many of you see folks dealing drugs on your pew? Yeah, that's the next one. How many of you regularly wake to sirens blaring? Yeah. And what are some of those thoughts that roll through your head when you hear the emergency vehicles just whizzing by your house? Any number of things. You're thinking about crime. You're thinking about emergencies maybe as a result of crime, much less anything else. And maybe you're just thinking, does that siren really have to be so loud? Jeez. But how about the less dramatic, right? What about yards untended and houses abandoned? What does all the chaos do to your heart and to your soul? Certainly chaos is nothing new, and in every age people have had these struggles, and in many cases struggles much worse. The Apostle Paul spoke into the uncertainty and fear that was present in the first century church when he wrote to the Philippians, and he said, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God, and the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." How many of you at some point in your life, or maybe now, have this memorized? Yeah. And so now you don't struggle with this, right? You got it figured out. Easier said than done. Easier said than done. I don't know about what's going on in your community, but I'll tell you about what's going on in mine. My family moved to this neighborhood in about 1998, I think. right around the corner on North Thompson Street. Any other? We've got some other North Thompson residents. Yes, North Thompson. Oh yeah, you were former North Thompson resident. That's right. Yeah, and I'm also former. But that was getting close to about 20 years ago, right? They sold the house in 2011, though I still lived there until the end of 2012. Squatters' rights and all that. For those of you that don't know, they sold it to the Benitas who have now who are now planting a vineyard church in Humble. And so I lived with them for a period of time. It was kind of weird because the whole world changed around me, the whole house, but my room didn't change. It was very very surreal because you kind of like wake up in the morning and everything's the same, and then you kind of leave your room and it's not the same. It was interesting. So, even in 1998, when we first moved here, the neighborhood wasn't in its glory days. Apparently, when the community was founded, it was, for a short period of time, the most affluent in the country, or had the most millionaires or something. What is that? A very short time per capita had the most millionaires in the country. So there was a lot of money in Conroe in those days, and there's been a lot of changes in the intervening years. So when my family got here, there was a woman that lived across the street. I think her name was Mrs. Elmore. She was in her 80s or 90s, I think, and, well, she died. A lot of other people have died since. And the generation that built this community, the generation that built this church, they're gone, you know, this building. And they've been replaced with many in the community that seem not to have maybe the same vision or resources that their predecessors had. So much of what you see in the neighborhood is decay and disintegration. Things seem to be falling down, falling apart. A number of years ago, we had this beautiful Methodist church downtown. Does anybody remember the Methodist church? That was probably my favorite building in Conroe. So what happened to it? Church moved out. City bought it. City tore it down. City, yes, city put up a very ugly government building in its place. We still have the Crichton Theater downtown, which is nice. I spent a lot of my junior high and high school years doing community theater there with the Crichton Players, which was awesome. But now the Crichton Players don't even perform at the Crichton Theater. They perform at another new, inferior building that apparently has very bad acoustics. So you see, it's not just the untended lawns and the homes that are falling down in many cases, some of which abandoned, being sold for the taxes owed on them. Though there are those of you that still live here that may be anxious for your property values because of those things. It's not just the decay of things once beautiful now looking shabby. It's also the lack of vision that allows us to destroy beautiful buildings rather than restoring them and replacing art with cheap functionality. And that's the real problem behind the impinging ugliness that we see in our communities many times, is simply a lack of vision. No one sees the potential in what they have. The book of Proverbs says that for lack of vision, the people perish, and it looks like the same holds true for communities. So what does Jesus do when it comes to a lack of vision? What does Jesus do when vision is lacking? Well, in John 9, as he went along, he meaning Jesus, he saw a man that was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. And as long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work." So what you'll notice is that the first thing that the disciples want to do is assign blame. They see a man in pain, but their top priority is an explanation. What is an explanation for pain, but usually simply an assignment of blame? The task of explaining these things, help us make sense of the world, and that would be all well and good if the only people that had cancer were the smokers, or only the people who got depressed were those who were lazy, if suffering really made sense and if bad things didn't happen to good people. It makes us feel smart and self-righteous when we can figure out how people deserve their suffering. And some of us, unfortunately, are very good at it. Assigning blame. Oh. So we try to figure out how people brought things on themselves and how other people brought things upon us often as well. So when you look around at a neighborhood in disrepair, the first thing you'll do is figure out who we can blame. Which politician should I hate? Which racial group or socioeconomic class can I vilify and scapegoat? Which economic downturn caused this and who caused that? Who's to blame? Immigrants, oligarchs, Wall Street, who can I blame? Jesus intervenes right in that moment and stops this thought process. He changes their perspective, and he says that brokenness, the brokenness that they see, the frustration that they're feeling is actually an opportunity for God to be revealed. And then he does something. While I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. And after saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it in the man's eyes. Don't try this at home. Go, he told them, wash in the pool of Siloam. The word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. So in this singular event, he's actually healing the vision of more than one person. He gives physical sight to the blind man, but he also gives vision to his disciples, who could only see the man as the product of sin and of poor decisions. He moved them from judgment to restoration. Sometimes that work is nasty. We have to assume that he picked up this mud spit concoction with his hands. And so there are these two elements to this healing. One is this shift from the present circumstances to the possibility and the potential, being able to see not only what is, but what could be. And the second is actually getting to work to make that change happen. And truly, the work of restoration is the work of looking for hidden treasures. Jesus has a parable about the kingdom. He says the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. And when a man found it, he hid it again. And then in his joy, went and sold all he had and bought the field. It requires you to see value in something that nobody else values. Because presumably whoever's selling this field has no idea that there's a treasure inside. And too often we look at people, we look at communities, we look at ourselves, and all we see is that empty, untended field that just looks like a big headache, a lot to mow, right? But there's something hidden in that field. I had the opportunity to help Raymond restore some of his house next door, and I could only help with sort of the unskilled labor. Mostly, I just remember spending a long time in the shower trying to wash off insulation, and that stuff's awful. But if you see pictures of this house, has anybody seen pictures of Raymond's house prior to his purchasing this house or right thereafter? You would not recognize that house. It looks like a completely different house, and essentially it is. I think there's very little left of that house that was there when he bought it. But the point is that Raymond saw something there that nobody else could have seen. If you saw that house, you wouldn't have wanted anything to do with it. And if that house wasn't a treasure hidden in a field, I don't know ultimately what was. And so what is the answer to our anxiety that we feel when we see a community crumbling around us? I think the answer is that peace is found when I stop complaining or blaming for decay and receive a vision of beauty. When we move past that place of just complaining that things aren't the way they should be or that they used to be or that they want them to be and stop just trying to figure out who we can blame and who we can just, you know, get really self-righteous about. When we can move out of that mindset and move to a place of seeing beauty, even where it seems as though there's no beauty, to a place of restoration. Because there's always somebody to blame. As a homeowner now, I'm generally, I guess, the person to blame in my community for an unmowed lawn. Though this week I'm blaming God for the rain because I couldn't mow my lawn because it was wet. So... there's always somebody to blame. I want to give some of you folks a shout out. I want to thank Mark Dawson for showing us about the beauty of lawn care. I mean, what it means to grow a good lawn. I want to thank, you know, Walter Bennett for being the gardener that he is, for bringing beauty out of the earth. I want to thank folks like Ken Ernst and Jackie Hales and Gary Wiley, who have made their business and their life's work to restore and build and create beautiful homes. Similarly, Randy Watts does a lot of that now. All these folks have helped maintain and restore the building that you're in now to keep it looking beautiful. And thank you guys and gals, the lay folks who come out and work on work days to keep this place up, to keep it looking beautiful. That we can bless our community with something beautiful to look at. I want to thank our artists like Joe Cobb, Shannon Fox, who draw and paint with such passion. Last go around, we had a growth group that was all about drawing. I want to thank our folks that are musicians, the people that were up here this morning, the people that are going to be up here tonight for bringing beauty through song and through music. To the poets and writers among you that inspire through words, I saw we're going to have a creative writing growth group this next time around. I want to thank our photographers and our videographers who capture and broadcast beauty, who see beauty sometimes even in very small things that go unnoticed. And I want to thank all you guys for that, because the presence of God is accompanied by beauty. And the Apostle Paul says that there's a hope of resurrection and restoration, not only for us, but for creation itself. And that those two things are linked, that our restoration is tied with the restoration of creation. In Romans 8, he says, "For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God," that's us, "to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into freedom and glory of the children of God." And so when you cultivate beauty in the world, you're undoing the work of evil. Undoing the work of sin and fallen creation, and you're ushering in space for the presence of God. And so will you ask God for vision for your community? Will you be willing to get your hands dirty in restoring and repairing what has decayed? To see potential and then do something about it. Potential in yourself, in the lives of others. Everywhere you look, can you see? Will you ask for a vision of beauty? Will I? Well, that's what's going on in my community. What's going on in yours?
Wow. You scared me there for a second. I'm not a former. I'm one who's here now and raised another one there. Connie's family lived in that house long before y'all got there. Now, some of you are sitting here saying, why are we talking about the community? Because this is the four corners that the church touches. It doesn't mean that your community is any less important and powerful to those effects. So I just say that real quick. As we talk about this, it's our hope tremendously to affect the community around us. And as I come in here, sharing for me what's going on in my community this year, when I came here and I moved here, it was exactly what Joel just said. Well, how beautiful you just put it, Joel. Was I saw the beauty, and you know, I called some of you, and you saw the beauty, and the Watts came, and Walter came, he even brought Susan, and it was awesome. And then, you know, the Gleasons came in with it. Just a lot of you came in, you said, man, I have the heart for the beauty of this place. And when you begin to see things going the other way, well, yeah, you get a little scared. Now, for me, what's going on in my community is the diversity of the community. Now, having said that, I moved here because of that diversity. I had grown up in an all-black community in the 60s and then had lived in Los Angeles there. I lived in the barrio by choice. I loved it there. I loved the mix of everything that was there. Teresa and I, when we married our kids, were at a school that 17 different languages were spoken there in the San Fernando Valley. The top one was Russian. And so we were used to diversity. And when we moved back here to Texas and we moved out to what then was the backside of the Woodlands in the woods, the only diversity I saw was, like, there was some deer and there were some pork. There's just different animals, you know, there were few people. And I remember thinking, I don't really like this. this isn't what I'm called to. There's something of different wiring. And we were called to plant. And when we found this neighborhood, what I loved about the neighborhood was the diversity, the socioeconomic diversity that was there, and the racial diversity was here. And I love that. Now, I'm sharing it because I felt that was something God put in me. That's not something that all of a sudden just came up. My heart was just loved it. And of course, now that my family is very diverse in race as well, and socioeconomically, we're very diverse because Teresa's got a lot of money and I don't. And I just remember living in L.A. and walking the streets. We would walk down, and I loved the funky old neighborhood that was there in North Hollywood that I lived in. And there'd be people who were homeless. We'd go up and sit and talk with them and buy them beer or a sleeve of Oreos or something and just hang out. We loved that stuff. But I've come to find out that the love for diversity, isn't just for me that was there. I know it was the Lord in the sense of this was the whole central message. One of the central messages of the New Testament is that Jesus comes and breaks down the barriers that are between the Jews and the Gentiles. And I'm telling you, that barrier was such that they couldn't eat with one another, couldn't be in each other's homes. It was unclean to be in the presence or with that person, let alone worship with them or live together with them. And, as we look at Ephesians 2, and it says, "For he himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility." And for me, this has always meant, yes, let's break it down. Being in the 60s, man, in a black community, it wasn't easy. I got called a lot of names. Cracker wasn't one of them. That came later. But, the point is, to see hostilities in a place where you can live and be together means a lot to me. It says he set aside in his flesh, Jesus did this, the law with its commands and regulations, the things that were separating those two guys, those two groups of people. His purpose was to create himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace, and one body to reconcile both of them to God through the cross. That there's something going on in the cross that's a little bit more than just your sins got forgiven. It's turn the prism and catch the light. It's burning bright. It's much more robust than just that. Which he put to death their hostility. He came and preached peace to you who are far away and peace to those who are near. For through him we both have access to the Father by one Spirit. And I always loved that verse because I always felt like I was the guy who was far off. Because it wasn't something that was easily accessible to me, the gospel of peace. The people came after me. I was a blues player playing in the bars, and my life certainly wasn't something that was readily available to God talk. And so it's always meant a lot to me to see that. I loved it when I came here, Teresa and I selling our house in the Woodlands and moving here by the railroad tracks. And I always say that first night when the train came by, and the house began to shake, and everyone pulled up in front of the tracks, and the boom boxes were going, and the house was shaking, and I said, I missed God. That wasn't God. My point is that I realized as a homeowner that this great, lovely idea of diversity began to cut into a sense of peace in my life. And I've made friends with that because the Lord really spoke to me then and said, you're just concerned with the price of your house and things. I've got something of the kingdom. It's more greater than just your own investment. You want to feel like you made a good investment so you can impress people. I want you to understand I brought you here. And so I made peace with that. But then things begin to happen in the sense that, as I look around and begin to see our community be a place where we have a lot of people who live in the streets. And they begin to walk through, and Teresa called me when I was in Mexico and said, someone's sleeping in the parking lot, and they're staring right into her house. So I went over to the office, and when I did, I stepped over someone who was asleep over here behind the church. I can't handle this, Raymond. I can't handle this. I don't feel safe. And so the tension was powerful for me. And I began to say, well, what's going on here? How can we help in these kind of things? But then my compassion began to get overwhelmed with, how can I keep my family safe? What about this? What about that? What about my community? They don't feel safe. They're not going to stick around. And I bring up the Conroe House of Prayer, which was a ministry that started out here that Luke Redis does over there with Compassion United. And I begin to see as people came and they offered a hot meal that the community began to, business owners begin to be scared and things begin to happen. And there's this tension of, wow, okay, what's going on? And even though I'm brought back to James where it says, listen, brothers and sisters, has not God chosen those who are poor in the eyes of the world to be rich in faith and to inherit the kingdom of the promise, those who love him? The kingdom he promised to those who love him. And my heart begins to say, oh, replace my compassion. I've got to know that you're doing something right. And I'm not here to really talk about how we example that. I'm just sharing the tensions in my life and what's going on in my community. And to realize that to others, I'm probably the scary one in the crowd. And I've had people say, I'm not comfortable in the church for this or that. And what can you say? But, well, God bless. But I love the fact. I'm finding, again, the peace and compassion of being part of diversity socioeconomically. And I love that. I love that God's kingdom is here. If he's promised it to the poor and the poor are present, then the kingdom's here. Well, that may be hard for some of you to wash down, fair enough. But then there's the other factor. Our community is becoming, it's becoming more or less one where it's more Latino. And I've done share with you, I lived in the barrio. I go down to Mexico generally once a year just to hang out with my friends in Guadalajara. I love to see the beauty of Guanajuato and León, and I just love that. I love it. I love speaking Spanish. I eat nothing but Mexican food anyhow, so that's pretty easy for me. But all of a sudden, the tension rose again. Why? Well, as I saw the culture changing, I began to see what become white flight. And I'm out here to get into racial discussion, but I begin to see, the change of community was around me. And I thought, well, how can I love these things, and yet it seems to be impinging upon what I had a vision for community to look like. I thought community could be this and that and the other, and now all of a sudden, you know, something's going on. Well, here recently with the many immigrants coming in from Guatemala and Honduras, El Salvador, where we've seen a lot of wars going on, these immigrants, and maybe you're one of them, have come to this country. Unlike the Mexican immigrants who came, they had generally some family and friends in place, and they were able to join and get to work and get things going and walk that American dream. It's been a blessing. But as these immigrants have come, they've not had those type of situations for them. And they've come into places where they've been stagnated, even held back. And I begin to get concerned, you know, when if socioeconomically, again, these things are going on. And then I'm so much reminded tremendously of Leviticus 19, where it says, when a foreigner resides among you in your land, don't mistreat him. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt, and I am the Lord your God. Now, when I say that, again, I'm not trying to speak of legal things of that nature. I'm trying to say my heart of compassion and how I hold and how I love. To not say, oh, if I share this dream with you, then my dream's gone. How do I walk in that tension? How do I know those things? It's the diversity that's hit me. But, you know, as I get into that, knowing that I've really enjoyed a lot of these kind of things, meaning I enjoy going down to a store that everything's in Spanish and shopping. I enjoy it. I get to do it occasionally. It's a treat for me. But what has become more of a situation I began to see was that, again, as I went back, many of the Central Americans who are coming up aren't transitioning to English as a second language. They're unable to. Financially, they're not able to get the breaks or what may have be there. And so I'm hearing more and more Spanish spoken on the streets of my community. When I walk down the street, it's buenos dias. That's the only thing that's spoken to me. And by the way, these are my friends. My kids go to school here, and I see that. And I thought, well, that's cool. But something began to happen. Inside, I begin to think, if Spanish is the only language spoken here, then my children won't be able to work here, and they're not able to live here because they're not being taught Spanish in their school because That's the way it works. And I begin to allow it to begin to bring fear to me in the sense that how could my well-being, how could this church exist in a community that is specifically Spanish? And I begin to let it begin to overwhelm me. Again, my peace was gone. And I begin to just go to the Lord and say, you brought me here. You're in charge of this community. And I want to give that to you. And you'll use me as long as you do. And again, I began to not get so afraid of viability and begin to say, Lord, I'm giving this to you. Again, this whole idea of understanding that as Pentecost is arriving, that we remember Pentecost coming through and the tongues were spoken and they were spoken to people in the languages that they could understand. And Acts 2:11 says they were staying in Jerusalem, God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. And when they heard the sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment because each one heard their own language being spoken. Utterly amazed, they asked, aren't all those who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each one hears them in a native tongue? We hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. It was a reversal of the dispersal that had happened at the Tower of Babel. As languages had allowed, had come, people were dispersed across the earth and barriers were put up. And here it became, again, something New Testament was saying, I've come to break the barriers down that even languages cause. And I read this and my hope begins to return and I say, okay, Lord, I'm trusting you. How? My vision for my community can be robust. It can be diverse. It can be real. It may not have looked exactly what I thought because, again, I can only think what's in my mind. But God has given me something, breaking the fear of losing viability, coming and moving in me, saying, yes, this is beauty and things are happening. I'm in what is going on. This isn't something that's falling apart. This is something I'm growing, something I'm doing. You see, peace is found when I appreciate diversity and choose unity over uniformity. That I want to be for, I want to be for the socioeconomic. I want to be with Compassion United hand in hand. I want to be over here with Angel Reach. I want to find unity. We're not the same. I get scared of these things, and they begin to bring it, and I stop and say, Lord, let me join with those who love you and begin to hang out. Let me look out and reach into those who are here who love this community because I want to love it with them, and I don't care what language they speak. I've lived there before, and it was beautiful. And with all of these things, choosing unity over uniformity, Revelation 7:9a gives us this view of what it's going to look like at perfection. I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language standing before the throne and before the Lamb. This becomes the perfection of the kingdom, the new heaven, the new earth. And anytime we can see that happening now in this day and age, people being healed, beautifying of the community that will be in ultra beauty when return of Jesus Christ with the sons of God come. Anytime we can see that diversity come together now, I say, yes, you have a vision for a community that's more and better than mine. And I say, yes, Lord, and rest in that and believe in what I have. It's been a blessing for me with that. So that's what's going on in my community. What's going on in your community?
Well, I'll tell you what's going on in my community. I am becoming one of the patriarchs of this neighborhood. As I moved here in 1995, 21 years ago, and I can validate all the changes that Joel and Raymond have mentioned. When we moved into our house 3 blocks up here on North Thompson Street, it was very different. We were the only young couple. And we weren't even really that young in comparison. We were in our 30s. Seth was one. Joel was on the way. But everybody in the homes around us was significantly older. In fact, most of the folks were the folks who were the original homeowners. Many of them the ones who built those homes, raised their families there, and were now in retirement. Their kids have gone off and, you know, were doing their own things. We were right in the middle of that. And so they all knew our family, if not by name, by description. And here's what I would hear as I would meet people in the neighborhood. At that point, I was working with the Church of Christ, which was literally three blocks to the west, now here three blocks to the south at the Vineyard. But I would see people and go, oh, yeah, yeah, you're the one with the three little boys. But like I said, they might not know our name, but they knew us by description. Because with three little boys in 3 years, little math there, 17 months between the first two, 19 the second, or backwards, 19 months between the first two, and then 17 months and the third one showed up. Shannon was always in the front yard. It was not unusual for me to come home, and she would have the little play pool out. She would be in the lawn chair, her feet in the little play pool, and the three boys are just all over. They're in and out. They're around the yard. They're just all over. And I would see the neighbors watching them from across on the other porches, just grinning and laughing, you know, just watching these little kids. And it was great. And we were in relationship with those folks. Shannon pushed the stroller through the neighborhood every day. Of course, the double stroller after Luke came along with him and Seth somewhere behind, maybe his little pedal car or whatever he, you know, happened to be working with at the time. And she would stop and they would all talk. You know, all these folks would come out and talk to them and, you know, get down in the little in our son's faces and just, you know, be nice and sweet. It was a great place to raise a family, a great place to know that because of those relationships, people were watching out for you. And anytime, I mean, we never worried about our house because there was always eyes from the front door and the back door watching. In fact, there were times that they would say, hey, we saw somebody come by. They were driving this vehicle. We wrote down the license plate in case we needed it. You know, and it was like, no, those were just friends from church dropping by. It was fine. But it was that kind of thing. And it was so good. In fact, in this quiet neighborhood, there were no boom boxes, as Raymond mentioned at that time. The train could be heard, but it wasn't quite the same. Again, because we're three blocks from the tracks. But one day I'm sitting in my office and I get this frantic call from Shannon. Joel is missing. Now, see, that didn't mean a whole lot to me because Joel was the one who, when you went to the doctor's office with one of the other kids, he would sneak into another office and hide. He would go in we would go to the store, and he would go and hide in between one of the circular racks of clothes. He would be in the middle of that, and the only way you would find him is his giggling, because he just thought it was hilarious that, Joel, where are you, where are you? You'd hear him giggling in there. So she calls me, and I'm thinking, okay, he's hiding somewhere. I said, so did you check this spot? Did you check? I have looked all over the house. I've checked the backyard. I don't know where he's at. So I go through the church office telling her, I gotta go, Shannon, Joel's missing. I probably use the term freaking out because that's what it seemed like to me. And I head out the door. I walk into the front yard and here she comes with Joel. She had just found him. Catty corner behind us were Mr. and Mrs. Traylor. Again, folks who built that home, they had relatives that lived down the street. They'd grown up here in Conroe, knew everybody. And Joel had decided that he would go visit them. Well, Miss Traylor just thought, well, no problem there. She just invites him in the back door and offers him milk and cookies. So literally 30 or 45 minutes after Shannon is completely frantic, here comes Miss Traylor with Joel. Yeah, he came by to visit, and we just sat and had milk and cookies. And of course, he's like, life is good. I show up at any neighbor's house, and they offer me milk and cookies or candy. But, you know, through the years, things begin to change. We began to see the transition, but also to be a part of the transition. I've attended numerous funerals for my neighbors. I've let go of relationships as our older friends moved to care facilities or into their children's homes because they could no longer take care of themselves. But in the midst of that, I changed too. I got more busy. Shannon at that time was a stay-at-home mom, but she went to teaching, which she still does and loves that. But with her not being at home every day, not walking in the neighborhood, we didn't meet the neighbors as freely as those transitions occurred. We started chasing our kids with school activities, as many of you do. You know, whether it was choir or particularly in our case sports, when you had three all playing sports, there was multiple games to get to and things we wanted to do. And so not only were we not in the neighborhood, we just really weren't home that much. So we watched a lot of this. And now we're reaching a time where, our kids have all graduated from high school. And I expect within the next few years, we'll be that old retired couple. Okay, maybe not so much the retired part, but we'll be that older couple on the block where, you know, our kids are off and gone and we're the ones who are doting over, you know, the other folks whose kids are going to the neighborhood. In fact, we already do that. I came home last summer as we've had a new young couple move in across the street from us, and I came home and Shannon had a friend painting with her in the living room. Of course, the friend was 5 years old. She may be six, actually, but it was the neighbor's daughter. She was out playing, and Shannon just went and introduced herself and said, "Hey, would you want to come paint with me?" And so, we're coming into that now. Yeah, that's right. I think we might have learned that lesson. We check with the parents before we take their kids off for milk and cookies. But with that being said, there's a tension there. Again, I expressed a while back, to the offense of at least a couple of people here, that I was concerned that the house across the street from me was becoming a rent house after watching the Ferguson family live there. Again, they had built the house, raised their kids, and then went to the husband's funeral. And then mom just, there wasn't a funeral because she just outlived everybody they knew. But the house sat for over 2 years empty. And then it was bought, rented out, and this young couple moves in. And they're delightful. Again, my confession in that sermon was I went from being concerned because, you know, renters won't take care of the property, they don't have the same ownership, blah, 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 all those negative things that I confessed. I'll say it again for those of you who are offended. I was confessing, not saying that was a truth. But we just love these guys. And I expect someday they'll end up here in some form or fashion. We're working on that relationship. And again, offering their daughter milk and cookies seems to help. But it's good. But if I'm supposed to be a representative of the kingdom in my community, what does that look like? In our busyness, in our lives where people literally open the garage door, drive out, go to work, pull back in, open the garage door, and they never go outside the house. It's all contained. How do you become a part of that? Well, let's look for a minute at John 4. You'll recognize this story, I think most of you. It's the story that we know is the woman at the well, a particular woman that Jesus has contact with. So in verse 3 of John 4, it says, "So he," meaning Jesus, "left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. As he's passing through Samaria, he's tired. He sits down by a well to rest. He sends the disciples into town for food, and a Samaritan woman comes out." Again, an issue we know for their culture because men and women don't interact with each other except under very private circumstances. And the Jews and the Samaritans definitely didn't interact with each other. They considered, the Jews considered the Samaritans, I don't know a better word, half-breeds. They had intermarried with other cultures, and they considered them, you know, as having betrayed the Jewish faith. So Jesus starts the conversation, and he basically, again, has a prophetically speaks into her life. They have this little banter, I believe, that goes on where she's a little rude to him, but he just keeps kindly kind of pursuing and interacting with her. And as their conversation ends, after he's spoken and prophesied over her life and the difficulty of her life, that she has lived with five men that are not her husband, and now or that were husband and now is living with someone who's not, he basically confesses, I'm the Messiah. I'm the one you're looking for. I'm the one who can offer this living water. And so often teachers have focused on Jesus' interaction as a way of evangelizing people. This morning, I want you to look for just a minute at the woman's reaction. A new main character in this story. In verse 28, after their conversation, it says, "Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, 'Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be Messiah?' And they came out of the town and made their way toward him." Now again, regardless of what we know for sure, she was at the well. Again, if you've been around church very long, you've heard the story told. She was at the well midday because nobody wanted to have anything to do with her. She was embarrassed and people stayed away from her. There's probably some truth to that, but regardless of any of that, her marital status certainly put her in a place where people would not have wanted to interact with her. So when she goes back into town, I'm curious as to what that looks like. Did all of a sudden they just accept her again? I doubt it. I have a feeling when she went back into town, she had to make a scene to even get their attention. Oh, here comes that woman again. Everybody turns their heads. They kind of duck. But somehow, because of her interaction with Jesus, she has a message for these people. She has a story. She has a transformation that has occurred in her life that she won't let go of, to the point that she gets them all excited and they go, well, maybe she does know something. Maybe we need to see what she's talking about. Maybe they just came from curiosity. Or maybe they came because they saw this withdrawn, isolated woman who was now willing to engage them because she thought she had something worth offering. So the disciples show up. Again, they're concerned that Jesus is talking to a Samaritan woman, and question that. And he, again, makes that a teachable moment for them. But again, in verse 39, it says, "And many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him," Jesus, "because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did." And ultimately, the next verse says, they came out, and they tell the woman, "We didn't believe just because what you said, but now we believe because we've met Jesus." You know, this is not the only time we see Jesus pursuing relationship with someone in a community and that person having impact. You remember the guy named Zacchaeus? Zac, as his friends called him. I don't know if they did or not, but anyway, he was the short little guy, climbed the tree because he had heard about this guy, Jesus, and he, again, a man who, because he was a tax collector, was certainly isolated, didn't have a lot of friends, thought, this guy says stuff that, you know, sounds interesting. I want to get a look at him. Jesus goes to him, goes to the house, and Zacchaeus' response is, if I've cheated anybody, I'll return it plus. And Jesus says, this day, this man has made himself, has become something that he wasn't before. He's become a son of Abraham. Again, he's become one of you again because of his interaction with Jesus. I can, again, the story ends there, but I wonder with Zacchaeus' newfound generosity if there wasn't a community center or a school or a hospital named after him in Jericho. I haven't been. Anybody been to the Holy Lands? Is there a Zacchaeus Hospital? But again, his life changed, but there was impact into the community. There's another guy. This one's a little hard to get a hold of because we only know him as Legion. Mark chapter 5, the one who was so full of demons. After Jesus heals him, he says, "Let me go with you." And Jesus says, "No, you stay and tell what God's done for you." And as we read later in the book of Mark, Jesus goes to an area called the Decapolis, the 10 cities. And in that place, they already knew of him. And at least chronologically from Mark's story, the only person at that point who lived there, Legion. Apparently this guy had impact on 10 cities because of what God had done in his life. You know, peace is found when I show love and pursue friendship with people in my community. And guys, I know most of you. I see you looking up. Okay, what's he going to say next? I know your love. I know that you love people. I know your hearts to a great degree. And I'm encouraged by that because I see the love of God in you. But I put to show love and pursue friendship for a reason. Because if I see somebody in need in my neighborhood, I, like most of you, would offer to help. But is my priority one of pursuing relationship? Again, time for confession. Mine has not been. Not because I don't care, but I'm just too busy. Well, or there's a good TV show on. I mean, you know, I can find quite a few excuses. In the book, The Art of Neighboring, the mayor of Arvada, Colorado, a suburb of Denver, is meeting with some pastors, one of which happens to be a vineyard pastor from that area. And so in his book, The Art of Neighboring, Jay Pathick mentions this, this quote. The majority of the issues, this is a mayor of the suburb, speaking to pastors because they asked this question, what can we do to help our community? He said the majority of the issues that our community is facing would be eliminated or drastically reduced if we could just figure out a way to become a community of great neighbors. Now, in our sermon prep time, we have enjoyed an exorbitant amount of mocking because the premise of this book is, as again, we word it, when Jesus said to love your neighbor, what if he meant your actual neighbor? And we've mocked and made fun of that endlessly because it's so simplistic, it sounds stupid. But I just happened to start reading the book this week because of the material I'm doing for my growth group. Yeah, it's simplistic, but it's also truth. I mean, we need to be good neighbors. And so much of the stuff in our community would be changed by that. That's how Jesus makes a difference in our community. He uses us. Whether it's this neighborhood, or it's RP, or it's Rivershire, or it's East County, or it's Spring, I don't know y'all's subdivision. But that's how Jesus wants to make a difference. He just wants to use us. And here's the basis for that. In 1 Peter 2, it says, but you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. So Peter kind of sets it up when he writes this letter. You know, there's the good part. Feel good about yourselves. You're all these things, Jesus says. Jesus has made you these things. And you were chosen to tell about the wonderful acts of God who called you out of darkness and into his wonderful light. Now remember, at one time you were not a people, but now you're God's people. In the past, you had never received mercy, but now you've received God's mercy. So, dear friends, you're like foreigners and strangers in this world. And so I beg you to avoid the evil things your bodies want to do that fight against your soul. People who do not believe are living all around you. And they might say you're doing wrong. But live such good lives that they'll see the good things you do and they'll give glory to God on the day when Jesus returns. I became a part of this church because I sat at what was then Tejas Restaurant with a pastor I'd never met before named Raymond McDonald, and he talked to me about his vision, that it wouldn't just be a church, but it would be a church in a neighborhood that had impact, not just in that people in the neighborhood knew about the church, but that even those who maybe didn't want anything to do with the church itself were affected by the ripple effects of what this church was doing. So that's what's going on in my community. What's going on in yours? Stand with me. There's a group that's going to be heading next door to help set up for the food pantry giveaway. So they're not leaving because they didn't like what I said, I hope. But give us a minute before you head over there. Because let's just take a minute and just ask God what He wants to do in our hearts. As Joel has talked about, seeing the beauty in places that our world has trouble seeing. And Raymond's talked about seeing people through new eyes, people of different culture, of even different language. And as I've been reminded that relationship is really what God is all about. I've always had a nice lawn. My wife has always kept up the flower beds. So I've done really good with that part of being a good neighbor. But I haven't really done a good job of pursuing relationship, of pursuing friendship. But I was reminded this week that in this community, that's something God wants to do. And again, He wants to do that. I keep saying this community because this one's mine. And it's yours because your church is here. But I hope you understand this has overflow into where you live. So come, Holy Spirit. Speak to our hearts. I pray right now that if there is any doubt within you that you were chosen by God, that you are holy, and that you're a people of God's possession, I pray right now by the power and authority of Jesus Christ that if there's any doubt in that, that it would be broken off. If you've believed a lie, if you live in shame in such a way that you can't accept that you were chosen by God and He has a mission for you, then I pray the Holy Spirit will meet you in power right now. And if that's you, I want to encourage you to come forward. If you struggle to believe that God has more for you, I encourage you to come and just invite His love to pour over you. Invite His identity to enter in you. And if you want your heart changed for your community, for your neighborhood, if you feel like you have You've been caught up in things that separate you from the people who live around you. I want to encourage you to come forward. And I'll get the ministry team here in a minute, but just come on up. If the Spirit's just speaking to you about any of these things, maybe even just about the busyness, and I know that would be an easy call, right? If you really want to get people down front, say, well, if you're too busy, come to the front. But wait, I've got to hurry to lunch. Yeah. Father, I just thank you that that you place us with people, that you're about relationship, that you loved us enough to pursue us, not to just give us those comfortable thoughts about living in heaven, which I believe is part of it, but to make a difference through us where we live today. Thank you. Thank you that you chose us. And help us to see what you're doing in the people around us. Today, if there's anything that serves as a barrier for you, between you and God or you and other people, that's the call. So you can come forward at any time. I'm going to bless and release others. Ministry team, if you would come up as you see the need, that'd be great. But Father, I thank you that you put us in the middle of this community and that especially here, you see things beyond what we see. I ask for your blessing to fall on each person, and that through them, their neighborhoods and their communities would see a difference. So I bless you now to go in the power of the love of Christ and in the knowledge that He has a mission for you to be a part of. In Jesus' name, amen.